It's Saturday, May 26, 2012. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio.
Scroll it, pose it, click it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, use it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, touch it, bring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, stop, format it, buy it, use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, mail, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, snap it, work it, quick, erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick, rewrite it, plug it, play it, turn it, rip it, crack it, drop it, zip, unzip it, surf it, scroll it, pose it, click it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging and capturing geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today's theme song is Technologic by Daft Punk. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to business and tech support for home computers. Home and Small Business Tech specializes in protecting data and in providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 20 years. HASBtech.com. During the second half of today's program, we'll be inviting you to participate with questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. But first, let's do some geek news. With Mr. Ben Jaffe. He's a freelance media dude. Hi, Ben.
Yeah, that song's been stuck in my head all day.
I know, it's great, isn't it? It was stuck in my head, so I figured I'd torture the central coast of California. And Mr. Miles Elam, he's a political analyst to some degree, or at least aficionado, I don't know, and a programmer. Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. So let's go ahead and start with you, Mr. Miles Elam. What's up with the news for you this week?
I was going to speak about a nice little bit of poetic justice.
Love those.
It's the best kind.
Yes. There are antivirus software out there, but there's also a lot of software out there that is actually the virus, you know, or maybe a link on a web page that says, hey, you've got this virus. Oh, come click on me and be safe. And when actually there, you have no virus, they're just this really obnoxious ad that's been injected into a web page. Some of these phony antivirus scammers even dial people's phone numbers and pose as companies saying you have this problem. We notice, you know,
there's a virus ISP, in your computer.
Yeah, we're at AT&T and we have a problem, or, you know, we're Apple and we, whatever. So these particular scammers were posing as Microsoft and saying, like, you have these problems, we can help out.
I think I've gotten a call from, quote, Microsoft before this.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So if Microsoft calls you,
unless you work for Microsoft.
Yeah, unless you work for Microsoft and you have stock in Microsoft or something like that,
no,
or you know someone from Microsoft, it's not for you.
Hey, it's your friend Ben from Microsoft.
It's very much like those emails from back in the day that said, you know, Bill Gates is giving away $1 million for someone who does.
So what do they actually tell the person that answers the phone?
Well, that varies, but the poetic justice was the fact that this particular scammer called the wrong person.
Ah.
They called a security researcher.
Nice.
They happened to get them at home.
Okay, so what did the security researcher do to them?
And the security researcher was thinking, like, oh, hey, like, this is curious. What do I do with... You know, normally, I was reading the story and was thinking, if I got a call from one of these folks, I would know that it was a scammer and just be like, dude, you know, and hang up on
right, and be a little depressed about society and humanity in general, but you'd hang up.
Right. But this person actually goes, let's see. I have a whole bunch of equipment that I had to work with. I have a honeypot. A honeypot being a server that looks like it's legitimate, but it's actually just a big bullseye for scammers and and actually viruses most, to go after.
Most security analysts do this. They set up machines that technically get infected, but really it's just a package on top that basically collects viruses and attempts. So they have an idea of what the infrastructure is like out there.
Right. Right. And so he lured the person into their honeypot and took a look and see what they were, saw what they were doing, posted a video of it online, which we'll be posting up to
did
the
they,
website.
Did they affect the attack? Did they get the person that was trying to manipulate him?
Well, you can just look at the story to see what it's about. But at the same time, it's... he was basically saying, he's not very technically savvy. Which is really the frustrating thing about the whole thing, is that most of the time when someone's scamming, they're not using anything sophisticated.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It just happens that they're...
The people that are really sophisticated in this are busy writing the applications. They don't use them. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So what you're saying is that the term for this we've used for years is script kiddie. This idea that somebody just collects some applications, some software, some scripts that do nasty things, and then they do nasty things with them. They don't actually know how those nasty things work necessarily.
But this is one step below that. This is more along the lines of, just get someone to, put certain settings into their computer to go someplace else, like set up a DNS server.
Not even a
to
script.
A different location.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So they're just
It's interesting because, of course, I think there's some set of people that know right away they're being scammed. Like a phone call comes in from them from their bank, and they're saying,
or
hi.
An email comes
right.
in,
comes in from their bank saying, hi, some issues are around. We need to talk to you about your bank, and you say, I'm sorry, I didn't initiate this call. Bye. You don't take calls like that because you don't know who they are, and so you say, well, can I get a number from you? And they give you a number that's not on your bill from your bank or whatever. Then that's not valid, right? There's people that like that space. I kind of conceive myself as that space. I don't trust any communication with me until I verify it, right? Just because the world's too complicated to do that. So there's that kind of person. And then there's a person that would, on a computer, know that an email is just bogus. Like, okay, emails, no, that's not true. It says my mom's in India and she's stuck. And she's actually in India. But until I get a call from my mom, I'm not going to respond to this because it's on the computer. But there is the people that are on the computer that have that kind of filter, that skeptic filter of communication, that might not exist outside. Their phone call space might be something that feels really real, and so they act.
See, so I can see funny. That some I people think they're actually the here. Same subset of society.
I think that we've trained people really well to some degree about how dangerous the computer communication can be.
Really?
I think so. Well, I mean, I should
say it's a very lucrative
what I'm saying is
black
there's,
market
I'm saying
out there.
We've trained 10% of people to be very skeptical on the computers. I don't know if those people are also skeptical on the phone.
I would say no. Okay. I would say absolutely not.
So you're not surprised, Miles. You think the same set of people could get tricked on the computer could get tricked on the phone.
I think there are a different subset, but I believe the amounts of people in each group are fairly comparable.
So how do you guys...
If anything, I would say the phone's subset is larger, but that's just because a large subset of the phone people aren't on the computer.
Right.
So...
Yeah.
All right. Whenever I cover these stories, I feel redundant saying it because we say it so often. Don't trust emails from people that don't trust email you're not expecting to get.
Well, don't trust anyone.
That's the reason why I get so upset about this. Is it's such a cynical way of looking at
life. Then you become a porcupine.
Well, don't trust anyone, especially us.
But this is like the same thing of when you go to a movie and you watch some amazing special effects. Like you also have to have that skepticism to say, is this actually true? You always have to approach everything with that level of, is this true or not?
Otherwise, The Day After Tomorrow would totally freak anyone who lived in New York City out. That's my home.
Thanks, Miles, for that story. Ben, hi.
Hi there. So I got a pretty awesome story about super slippery coatings. So we all know about Teflon. We have it on our various cooking apparatuses.
I thought I was going to talk about software. I've never heard of Teflon, the software.
Yeah, Teflon. It's this great...
Go on.
Anyway... There's now a super hydrophobic spray, which is for clothes that makes them resistant to dirt, resistant to getting soiled or stained. They're super hydrophobic, that's a hard word to say, films that make circuit boards more water resistant. And now we have a new coating that is actually food safe. So we can use it for things like ketchup bottles. Because when you go to
is this coating super hydrophobic?
Yeah.
Okay. That's the right word, hydrophobic?
Yeah.
Super hydrophobic. It's scared of water, like me.
That's what it sounds like, right. What is it, guys?
Yeah, that's what it is. Something that doesn't bind to water.
But why is it? Why is phobic? I thought that was a fear-based thing. That was a psychological term.
That's just no. That, no. 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 It's something with
an aversion to.
Say
something
aversion is, to. Okay.
Yeah, phobic or philic.
Gotcha.
So hydrophilic would be something that reacts well with water. Gotcha. Hydrophobic, something that does not mix with water.
Okay, hydrophobic. Yeah. Okay, so this hydrophobic coating, the other stuff you were talking about, it was really fun for spraying in electronics or putting it over things. But if you ate it, not so good. This
probably
one, supposedly, you
so
can
good.
Interact with your food.
Well, the really cool thing about this one is that it is made from only things that the FDA has already approved for either consumption or for products that aid in the creation of consumable goods or something like that. Yeah. And there's this article is actually quite hilarious too. It has a video that shows a clear plastic bottle that has been coated with this and a whole bunch of ketchup inside, and they turn it over and the ketchup slides out and there's no ketchup inside, and it's like magic, you know.
Yeah.
Now here's my question. Ketchup manufacturers, will they go for this? Will they say, hey, we've got this awesome bottle? Or will they shy away from it and try to actually avoid people using it? Because, of course, think about it. Ketchup margins, if you have, let's say, 15% of ketchup remains unused in every single bottle, which I don't think is really an over-exaggeration. It's probably somewhere between 5 and 15% is my guess. That's a lot of extra product that people buy and don't use, which means that for any given amount of use, they buy more ketchup bottles.
Certain.
For, you know, using that amount. So, I mean, this could...
So, we have a magic new fruit...
the ketchup industry.
And mayonnaise.
Well,
first, also, I don't want all the ketchup out of the bottle right away. That would be bad.
No.
You can pour it slowly still.
Not all the way. Well, yeah, I mean, so
it's
so the other thing
is... It's
easier
to pour, yeah.
Yeah, it is. The other thing, though, it just will slide right out. The other thing is you do need to still have a little channel of air. So
sure,
if you turn it entirely upside down, all the air inside the bottle goes to the top.
So
it creates a vacuum, and then no ketchup comes out.
Okay, Ben's trick for ketchup pouring, so clarify that again. Even with a normal bottle that doesn't have super hydrophobic coating.
Oh, I've heard a number of different things. You can either hold it kind of at maybe a 30-degree angle down and then bang along the side or bang along the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
But I've actually found most... successful if you bang along the side, because it doesn't clog up the opening of the bottle.
All right. I'm going to let you guys in on a secret, because apparently you're not privy to the secret society for this. If you have
a knife.
If you have Heinz ketchup,
yeah,
you know the little 76 symbol?
Yeah.
That's where you hit.
That's just total faux. Just total.
No.
No?
Hit that spot, and that's how...
And you're talking about the bottle almost at a horizontal to the table. It's a little bit more than lower at the end.
Yeah, 45-degree angle. And you
that's not 45.
That
45 would clog
is
up.
Like whop.
No,
really?
Yeah. We're talking about angles on the radio.
Can you do Zachary's after this? We'll go over and have food. Okay.
Yeah, we'll go.
You want to do that?
Sure.
Okay, we'll go have that. And I'm not going to eat ketchup because I'm doing a zero carb diet. But
fan of ketchup.
But, I know. But we'll take some ketchup and we'll pour it.
Excuse me, sir. Do you want some ketchup with your food? Here, we
Miles not going to join us for that.
I can't.
Well, if any other listeners want to join us. Don't. It's a really busy restaurant.
Very bad.
Or if you know us personally,
very
please
bad
give us
company.
Calls. All right, but in any case, this slippery surface material that sprays onto stuff and sticks supposedly and doesn't come off, can you put it on anything? Can you put it on dishware? And like if you put it on a plate, when you clean your plate, you just turn your plate sideways and everything falls off of it?
Yeah, except imagine trying to cut a grape or something like that. Or like trying
How
to cut,
often do you
trying
cut
to
a grape?
Anything.
What are you doing?
That's a good point. How often do you try to cut it? Well, maybe stabbing a grape. But I imagine that the friction of the plate helps a little bit,
okay.
Maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
But maybe I'm just making that because they're usually...
Wait, would be really
wait I'm sorry. Hard. Have you ever tried cutting a grape with a knife and fork on a plate? Like,
that's what I said. It's
not going to... The fact that it's has a hydrophobic film or not is not going to change the fact that you can't do it.
Miles, or that it's useless.
You always have to call me out. Okay,
what
fine.
About what about maybe a whole bunch of peas on a plate? It'd be impossible.
Yeah, right.
It means that you wouldn't need a dishwasher anymore. You could just...
The thing is, peas don't stick
except
to plates
Except
there
would have
anyway.
To be... except...
So I'm not convinced that this makes it completely clean, but I do think that... All the material comes off.
It like would the if you had material. Something that was hydrophobic as well as, now I'm trying to think of the term for it.
Oilphobic?
Oleophobic, uh-huh. I think is the term.
Oleophobic.
When Miles makes up words, he thinks about it for a while.
No. It's oleophobic, something like that.
So you're scared of olives?
I have a friend who's scared of olives.
Wait a second.
Yeah.
So the thing is with this, I mean, some people still think that Teflon's bad. Like there's this perspective that it's nasty because it's not natural, if you will. What is this stuff that's sprayed on? And are we going to start seeing it on things?
From what I know about the research on Teflon and those chemicals and additives to pots and everything, is that there's not enough research to say definitively enough either way.
Okay. But this is a coating that it goes on material. It's not being released yet, but soon it will be. And it allows things not to stick to it. It's basically WD-40 that you can taste.
Yeah, exactly.
That you don't eat.
that you don't taste.
Yeah.
But I mean, one of the big advantages of this particular coating is that it's all FDA approved stuff. See, so it'll go through probably a lot more quickly.
If it's FDA approved, then it's fine, right?
Yeah, exactly. But you can always use the squirt bottles instead. I mean, why are we talking about the glass ketchup bottles? You can just use the squirt bottles.
Those for ketchup, doesn't make any sense.
By the way, oleophobic.
Yeah. I knew it was right.
Although that's actually right. Refers to the physical property of a molecule that's repelled from oil. The real term, which I didn't get, the chemical property, is lipophobicity. Lipophobicity.
Oh, that sounds better.
Lipophobia.
Lipoids, right, makes sense. Okay.
So lipids, fat rejection.
I have lipophobia.
Let's move on to the East Coast, shall we? What's going on in New Jersey, Miles?
Let's say you're the mayor of a small New Jersey town and you are doing things that your constituents don't like very much. So they put up a recall election. And there's a site.
That would happen if I was a mayor of a small New Jersey town. I know that would happen.
And so a website was put up that's advocating, that mayor's recall.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a common thing during a recall. It's a common point for people to go there, find out more about the issues, make a decision. Now, it gets a little bit more touchy when the mayor and his son perform a denial of service attack on that said recall website.
And get caught.
Right. What they did actually was they got unauthorized access to the domain registrar.
Uh-huh.
And they redirected the DNS to go to a different server, different IP address.
That's not really a denial of service attack in the way we normally talk about it.
Right. Yeah, well, it is a denial of service attack. It's not it's not flooding it with packets. It's simply denying the service.
Right.
The FBI arrested them.
Well, they did. I mean, yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, jeez.
So what you're saying is if you are going to run and then you get opposed, if you plan on taking down the website illegally, make sure it's not like your direct family members doing it.
Well, make sure it's not yourself and your direct family members doing it. The mayor was involved.
You know, I love this idea. I wonder how old the son is, because I can imagine, dad, we could just not make that website work anymore. Oh, what do you mean? Oh, it works like this. And they start doing it, right? And the father doesn't really get that what they're doing is very wrong. Because they're not necessarily the technology.
Okay.
But you're going to go with...
Let's go with the they're in New Jersey.
Oh my gosh. Now,
anyone who's from New Jersey, yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
You can call us in a few minutes at 800-655-5877 and give us your opinion if you are from New Jersey. Or if you're not as well.
If you want to unleash any wrath... Unleash it at Miles.
Ben, what's your next?
New Jersey is known for many things. Yeah. Clean elections is not one of them.
Mm-hmm. So if you're an election official in New Jersey,
then you can call up and say, yeah, he's absolutely right.
Fair enough.
Ben, go ahead.
So, really fantastic news. SpaceX has successfully docked with the International Space Station. And that makes it the first time... up until now, sending a spacecraft to the space station has only been accomplished by the United States, Russia, Japan, and the EU.
Government entities.
So this is now the first private entity that has sent up a spacecraft and docked it with the ISS. So this is fantastic. And assuming everything continues to go as planned and the mission is successful and with maybe a few more tests, then SpaceX is going to start... SpaceX is, by the way, the company, the private firm that did this. And they're going to be starting to fulfill a government contract, a $1.6 billion contract, and they're going to haul cargo up for NASA in 12 different flights to the ISS. because NASA doesn't have its own vehicle anymore now that now that the shuttle is gone.
And this was an unmanned mission, right?
Unmanned
mission, mission.
Unhuman mission. Mm-hmm. Yes. Only bacteria.
Ooh. Oh, really? They do have some science experiments on them? Or are you saying that everything is bacteria?
Well, I'm just saying that everything is bacteria. But yeah, they do actually have a number of science things on there. Actually, right. I think there was a competition for school children where you as a school child could submit a proposed experiment to go up and go up with SpaceX to the ISS. I'm pretty sure that's the case for this particular launch. And so there are actually a lot of pretty interesting experiments that have all been conceived by children.
Cool.
Very cool.
Thanks for the space update, man.
I really wish, like, where were they when I was a child? Like, I would have loved to send something up in space.
Let's see, the mid-90s. Let's move on. Miles, hi. What's going on with that? Let's talk a little bit about, I don't know, media and such. Go on.
And another wonderful day with Lyle Segways.
At least you're actually telling me what you're going to talk about next. Ben's silent over here. I have no idea what his next story is. But of course he won't have
Fox,
one.
Fox, NBC, Universal, they are suing Dish Network.
Why?
Yeah, it's really odd because Dish Network is actually serving their content, right?
Yeah.
And Fox and
NBC, probably paying them for it.
Yeah, Fox and NBC Universal are actually bemoaning that fact that we have to go after this person that's serving our content, or this entity that's serving our content. It's over the DVR that comes with Dish Network. It has an ad skipping.
Specifically a button that says skip ad? Interesting.
Yeah, a technology specifically for that purpose. You know,
so like you push a button and it jumps you ahead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
doesn't every DVR have that?
Well, besides that, I was just thinking the reason they're suing is saying that it's violating copyrights and destroying the fundamental underpinnings of the broadcast television ecosystem. And
the second part I get, in the sense that, yeah, if you don't have ad revenue anymore, you've got a problem.
Yes.
But the first part, why is it violating copyright?
Because that stream that's coming in, that's a copyright owned. So when you edit something, it's going to be a change of that material.
Don't you edit it when you turn the TV off and turn it back on?
That's the thing. Like, this is where I have these mixed feelings about it. Like, yes, because they are advertising something as specifically we're going to cut out the ads from this material that's coming down through our service, and we have a partnership with that service. So there seems to be a conflict of interest there. At the same time, it sounds to me very much like a certain TV exec that was saying that if you watch TV and then you get up to go get snacks or do something during a commercial break, you are thieving.
Right. Well, I mean,
and let's be clear. There was a TV exec who actually said this.
Yeah. The general idea is if you're not watching the commercials, you're actually stealing the content. That was what the exec said. It's ridiculous, of course. And everybody's always left the room for commercials, except for everyone's mom when you don't. And people all have been muting commercials since the remote control came around.
And this is also the argument given in the 80s, saying the VCR is to broadcast TV what the Boston Strangler is to the single woman at
another ad exec, by the way.
Yes. Or media exec.
Yeah.
And it's like, now that when VCRs were produced, did people stop watching movies, going to the movie theater, or did they stop watching TV?
Well, you know,
ads stop having any
effect? The thing is that this ad thing has been happening for a while. I mean, remember there was a setting for a while that would detect when an ad happened because of the compression rate of the audio, right? So it would detect it and just skip ahead.
Or in some cases, the volume level of the audio.
Right. Yeah. But the thing that's so surprising to me is that Fox and NBC Universal wouldn't just say, Dish Network, stop it, or we'll pull your channels from your system. Because if they pulled their channels from the system, it would be pretty drastic for Dish Network, wouldn't it? Or would it not matter because there's so much content out there now that the distributors are the ones that own the control?
Well, I would imagine it's a separate contract issue. They have a contract with each other to provide
that
service.
And they just don't have that line in there.
You have a suit that is not directly related to that contract.
Okay, I'm not a lawyer. We'll move on. No, but I can't imagine a contract between a distributor and a content provider that doesn't cover the fact that you've got to make sure our ads are in line with the content, that you're not modifying the ads. That has to be in there right off. And that's probably what the basis of the suit is, right? Because when NBC Universal says, okay, Dish Network, you can distribute our content, but don't modify it. That would be part of the contract right off the bat. So it really must be about that issue that Dish is not necessarily modifying it themselves, but they're giving control that's so easy to the user that they're arguing that that breaches their contract. And that's the issue. The question I've got is, if Dish Network is providing this, why would they advertise that that's the feature set? I guess because everybody uses it that way, right?
Because customers actually want that. I don't know. Let me just throw that out there.
They want to skip the ads? No, no, no. People want to pay for the content. They want to watch those commercials. That's
you know what I would love? Ads that didn't insult my intelligence. Ads that I didn't get through that 30 seconds saying, my brain is leaking out. I can't believe they just said that.
Miles, I think you underestimate how intelligent you are. If the ads were based on not insulting your intelligence, no one would understand them. You're too smart, sir, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah,
did you get that? Did you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. I got another story to cover that particular aspect. But that's
that lack of intelligence? Okay.
Something like that.
You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. We have the genius Miles Elam in the house and also Ben Jaffe, who's no slouch as well. Together, the three of us can answer any questions about technology you have to offer. And we'd love to hear your opinion about what we've been talking about. Or interesting tidbits of news you might have heard during the week. You can give us a call.
Any question? Really, that's a bold statement.
We can answer any question. It's very easy to answer.
Whether we answer the questions correctly is the key.
That is the underlying caveat of the show. Yes, exactly. It is just our opinions, of course, nobody else's. The phone number to call in is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. And I know I talk fast, so I'll give that number out again in just a minute. Geekspeak on KOSP is supported by Dr. Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in handcrafted dentistry from start to finish, using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. Information is at RamirezDDS.com. Geekbit, either of you, please?
Yeah, I have a Geekbit. Did you guys by chance see the solar eclipse?
Yes.
Yeah?
It was delicious.
Some of it.
Very, very clever. So yeah, so from Santa Cruz, San Francisco, that whole area, we couldn't see the entire solar eclipse. But man, it was cool.
It was cool.
Yeah, and the thing I really enjoyed about it was you can make these little pinhole cameras, right? So you just punch a little piece of foil just with a pinprick right in the middle, and it creates a little not lens. What would the
lenses
term for that be?
Yeah, lens is the right term.
Yeah, and so on the other side of it, in the shadow, you can actually see an inverse version of the solar eclipse. And so I started doing that with my hands, like holding my fingers up in parallel to each other, but my hands perpendicular, and creating a grid of little holes, and you could see all the little eclipses on the ground.
Cool.
Very, very cool.
I'll put up a video of trees doing that.
And I got one.
Go ahead.
Tony Stark. Character made popular by Marvel Comics as the Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
They've made a couple of movies.
Womanizer, a drunk, go on.
Yeah, something like that. But also a genius.
Yes.
And one of the big deals in the first movie is that he's caught in the middle of the desert, and out of random rocket parts, he's able to produce this suit.
Robotic suit, sure.
Yes. Sorry for any spoilers out there for people who don't know
Iron Man Beta, if you will, or Alpha, maybe.
But there's a real-life version of this. There are a couple people who are really good, but I just want to bring up this one particular guy. Emile Leray, Frenchman, which explains my really bad French accent just now.
Okay, good, good.
Where he had a broken down car in the middle of the northwestern African desert, and that car, just to give you some point of context, it's a Citroen 2CV. Think of it like a Pacer, only not quite as sporty.
Okay.
Like one of those 70s Pacers.
For people who know as much about cars as I do, you could say it kind of looks like a bug.
Okay. A VW bug.
Only not as sporty.
Not as...
Yeah, like a really, really
more boxy.
Decrepit.
Thank you, Ben, for that Central Coast translation. I appreciate it. Go on.
What do you do when you have a broken down Citroen? You're in the middle of the northwestern African desert.
Drain the radiator into a pail and start walking?
No.
Well, I guess that'd be bad with antifreeze. I'm going.
What you do is you take your standard toolbox and a hacksaw. All the materials that he had available to him. You take that apart, that the Citroen apart, and you make a fully functional working motorcycle that you then drive at ride
no
out.
No way. The desert. No. Wait, what? What was broken with the car that the motorcycle still came out of it? I guess maybe the rear axle or something. Something was broken that you don't need in a motorcycle, I would assume, some of the wheels. Wow. Cool.
And it looks like something out of...
How big is
it? It looks like something out of Mad Max.
How big is the engine?
Not that big. I mean, it's...
It must not be. It's hard to... Very cool. All right. Then more information about all these little geek bits, of course.
But just... You can go into the website to see it, but I'm going to give Lyle a quick preview just so you can hear his reaction.
Mm-hmm. No way. No. There's no way he did that with standard parts.
Yes.
That doesn't look real. That looks like it was CG'd.
That was actually my reaction. It looks like
a computer graphics
CG'd vehicle from Star Wars Episode 1.
Is CG'd appropriate?
Sure.
Computer graphic?
No, generated.
Computer generated. Okay, good. All the geek bits imagery. Specifically, so people that don't know what geek bits are, they're little things that we think are cool that you kind of have to see. So you have to go to geekspeak.org. So geekspeak.org will have this information eventually. Hey, you can call in with questions and comments about technology. We will take any calls today on the show about technology, questions, comments, whatever you'd like, and we'll see what we can do to answer them correctly. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Monterey Bay Unified Air Pollution Control District, encouraging the public to celebrate clean air monthly by leaving your car at home and biking, carpooling, or using public transportation instead. Information about Clean Air Month is at MontereyBayCleanAir.org. We'll take questions and comments as we get them in, and we already have one. Oh, don't we? Yes. Oh, sweet. I don't think it's going to work, but we'll give it a shot.
I just love, audience out there, don't you just love how excited we get about your calls? Oh,
see?
Denied. Now you can hear our abject horror.
I know. Should we make fun of Aptos? No, let's not. We will take your calls, the questions, comments, the technology. The dial tone is just to remind you how easy the phone is to use. You just punch in 1-800-655-5877 and you'll get KUSP. And if it happens to be right now, live, during, you know, the 10 o'clock hour on the central coast of California, then we'll answer the phone. If not, we're not answering the phone. Somebody else will. Let's go ahead and do another geek bit, or let's do another story, shall we? Miles. No, Ben. Let's talk about I don't know, something very science fiction-y.
Sure. So I was watching Star Trek Deep Space Nine last night.
Good. You win.
I do. Actually, I'm going through the entire season.
It's amazing how well that holds up. I watched it again recently.
DS9?
Yeah, too. And
oh my god, you're one of my few friends who also watches DS9. I didn't know.
Oh, I watched it when it originally came out. I mean, you were too young for that. But
boldly sit where no one has sat before.
That's actually fairly accurate, except they have runabouts and they go out on shuttlecraft and everything.
They do have a wormhole.
Anyway, you know what? Everyone disses it. It's a fantastic show. I really think it's a fantastic
show. I didn't like it as much as Next Generation. And then I watched Next Generation and Deep Space Nine one after another again recently after we finished Next Generation. Then we watched DS9. And Next Generation was more fun and happy and, you know.
Yeah.
And it was a good show, don't get me wrong. But DS9 was like, it had some really dark moments, had some real just...
It had a lot of development too. A lot of character development and a lot of, like, the situation's always roughly the same.
So. Anyway, I don't mean
go
to
derail
you. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. So the reason I brought up Star Trek is because, so on last night's episode, they were towing in a runabout using a tractor beam, and I thought, God, wouldn't it be cool if we had tractor beams? So I looked in the news, and I found that, in fact, we have three different techniques for towing things. Now, these are usually very, very, very small things like particles or whatnot. And just to run through the three methods that we have, one is we have, it's called optical tweezers. If you look it up, basically you have two laser beams and you trap an object in the focus of both of them.
Sure.
And so you can use that to move objects. Another one is you can have a laser beam that's actually, instead of being more intense in the center of the beam and falling out, it's actually less intense in the center, and it's almost like a ring of a beam.
Uh-huh.
And then you can actually trap particles inside of there and move them around that way. There's also a third one that uses what are called bezel beams, and this was theoretical, but recently, actually, it's been proven, very recently, it's been proven at the A-Star Data Storage Institute. And bezel beams seem fairly complex. Basically, instead of being at the same amplitude the entire length of the beam, it actually changes intensity at different points throughout the beam. And so you can use those properties to move molecules.
What kind of beam are we talking about?
Yeah, that's
it's called a bezel beam. Apparently, if you want to create a proper 100% correct real bezel beam, you need an infinite amount of energy. But we can optically simulate these things.
Interesting. And so it is electromagnetic spectrum beam.
Yes.
Beam of electromagnetic waves. Okay.
Yeah, but you can also do it with sound. You can do it with a number of
it
things.
It kind of makes sense, Miles. If you do multiple frequencies that interact with each other, you can get two carrier waves together. Mm-hmm, kind of. Mm-hmm. I mean, I am guessing wildly here because, of course, we're also at the nanoscale, so our idea doesn't actually work.
That and we are woefully undereducated.
Speak for all of us. Oh yeah.
Speak for yourself. I watch a lot of Star Trek. they tractor beamed. They tractored something at warp.
Of course, they
tractored it out of warp.
That's really hard.
They had to dump the warp core, and everything just went haywire from there because they opened up a singularity, and then.
Going on. Ophelia from Aptos, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question today?
So I want just a little bit of advice. I finally made the decision to buy one of the more modern TVs, and I did that last week, and it's a 720 format.
720p, sure, probably. Uh-huh.
Exactly. And I also have an iMac, and so I was considering getting the Apple TV unit. But then I saw this Blu-ray player with Wi-Fi.
Okay.
And it supposedly has a web browser in it. And so I was wondering what your opinion is about that.
Okay, so not necessarily just web browsers, but a lot of these devices actually have services embedded in it, like Netflix and things of that nature, that allow you to play content through your Blu-ray player. It is interesting. If you have a lot of Blu-ray discs around, the Apple TV solution won't actually work, right? Because the Mac doesn't have a Blu-ray player and the Apple TV has no disc player. Miles, do you have an opinion on this?
Yeah, the web browser that's in a Blu-ray player or web browsers that are embedded in TVs tend to be fairly shifty. Wait, no, that's not the term I wanted to use. It's an SH sound and it ends in a Y.
But it's like shifty, but it's not.
But it's like shifty or shady.
So what he's saying is that web browser won't be any good. Is that a good analogy?
Yeah, unless you have a keyboard, typing in URLs is absolutely painful. Unless you have a mouse, it's really hard.
But if it is like Netflix enabled or one of these services like that, and you have that service, then it's pretty functional.
Using things like Netflix or Pandora or Hulu or all these Voodoo, I mean, those I highly recommend. I use them myself at home. But web browsing, you really do kind of need a dedicated device for that, whether that be a laptop or a tablet.
Yeah, I agree. And Ophelia, do you have a lot of Blu-rays in your life?
I've never had one.
I think that having something allows you to watch content streaming easily, and since you already have an iMac and you already can do it through that, and the web TV box is, I think one of the other geeks, Al, has one. He absolutely loves it. But then again, he owns a lot of Apple stock. So.
No, I mean, the Apple TV is great for that. If you already have one, then I agree with Lyle. If you don't, those Blu-ray players, because they also play DVDs and they play Blu-ray and they do all that streaming content as well, I like mine.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I have it.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for the call.
Thank you very much.
And about 720p, that resolution is much better than standard television, right? So if you have content that's outside the normal space, like it's going to be a lot better than a standard DVD. And you will notice it if you watch content that's different, you'll notice it comparatively.
Yeah, it'll be twice as good, four times as many pixels.
Yeah.
Not quite four times as many.
Almost twice as good, almost four times as many pixels.
Thank you, Ophelia, for the call. Take care.
Well, can I ask you one more question?
Go ahead.
So if the Blu-ray player is 1080, but my TV is 720.
Then it'll fall back to 720.
That'll be okay.
It'll fall back to 720,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Anything that can go 1080 can step back as well. Thanks for the call.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
We'll go ahead and go to the next call, shall we? This is going to be in Santa Cruz. Robert, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, my name is Robert, and I am not a great typist. And sometimes when I'm typing, I'll look up, and I'm way, way off of the page.
Okay.
Do you have a laptop?
Yes, or any kind of computer. It doesn't matter. Suddenly the cursor will be up in a totally different line than I was typing in, and I'm typing away, and I have to cut and paste what I typed. Or
are you talking about laptops
only, or is this on all keyboards?
No, it's all keyboards.
Okay, because laptops traditionally have a cursor device that's kind of really close to the keyboard, either like a little
trackpad or a pointing device.
Yeah, and those things can sometimes get hit. The other thing that can happen pretty easily is there's a home and next line and or page up and page down buttons to the right, and if you hit one of those, it'll also jump around. Other than that,
and also if you bump your mouse,
or
if you're typing heavily enough, I've seen this happen before. People were typing on the keyboard heavily enough that it's actually because their desk is not perfectly level. It's moving the mouse.
Yeah, but moving the mouse wouldn't put the cursor in the new spot unless the mouse button gets clicked. So
if you had kind of a funky mouse and you were typing really hard.
So no, here's, I think
right, the most likely is probably because most computers are laptops these days, it probably has to do with the trackpad.
Yeah.
So your thumb is probably brushing the little trackpad, the area right below the keyboard that you use to move your mouse.
Yeah, and if you have like a keyboard and you put it on, if you have an external keyboard and you put it on top over the trackpad, that can cause problems. Anything on top of a trackpad can cause problems.
Yeah.
So I would really, when that you experience that, think about where the pointing device of the computer actually is. And then also try to figure out if a keystroke that you're doing, like an up down arrow, might be being hit when you're depressing the shift key or the return key or something, that you might be actually also hitting an up down arrow on the keyboard. Please. But that's pretty much all I've got for you, Robert.
Please. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call.
Also, I've actually seen a lot of people the bottom left and the bottom right of the heel of their hand can also often hit the trackpad.
Oh, that's something I forgot to bring up. There are a lot of computers, if you plug in an external mouse, it will disable the trackpad. Or you can put in a setting to do such.
Right.
To do such, so it might be worth it to plug in an external mouse and continue typing and seeing if it still happens.
Right. Plugging an external mouse.
Some do that, some don't. I don't think Apple's do.
Moving on. From Salinas, Ronnie, welcome to GeekSpeak. Ronnie, you with us today?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, what's your question? You're on air.
On my Nano, I've got the voice that's in the background. It pops up every once in a while. I'll tell you about what song and everything about the song.
Uh-huh.
Set that off?
Yes. Next call? No, I'm just kidding. You want to know how?
Yeah.
It's, I don't know. How do you modify a Nano?
I think it's through iTunes.
Yeah, I think so, too.
I think if you go into iTunes, somewhere in the settings, there is...
Have you connected this device to iTunes?
Yes, when I download songs.
So okay, when you're connected, you select the Nano device. It'll show up on the side in iTunes. Select that. And when you select that, you'll actually have a page of settings. Look through those settings, and you'll find the thing. What's it called?
I think it's called VoiceOver and Spoken Menus. So
Spoken Menus,
so I think there are two checkboxes.
It'll definitely be in the summary.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for the call.
VoiceOver,
yeah.
So uncheck both of those checkboxes, and then you should be good.
And then you want to save the settings or commit the settings, and it might sync and do some changes, and then see how it goes. Good luck. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
I'd be a lot more lonely though if my iPad was talking to me.
It's
the
only voice that's with you all the time. From Scotts Valley, John, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh hi, thanks for taking my call. And what I would like to do is start a blog, and I would like to have it. Email the people who are members of the blog whenever I post something new.
Okay.
And I'm talking about a couple of hundred people might be members, and I'm wondering if there's any free software out there that would let me do that.
Well, right off the bat, what I would think of is like the most common application for starting blogs when you run your own, which you'd kind of have to do rather than run the service, is WordPress. And you can go to wordpress.org and learn about it. And on WordPress, there's actually a company as well. That's wordpress.com. And there is a plugin for like emailing users. In fact, it's kind of a standard one, I believe. Though, no, maybe it's not totally standard. It's called Email Users. And that plugin, if you add that to your WordPress, allows you at any time to email all the users. Actually, doing
it. The plugin, does that come from the WordPress people?
Yeah, when you actually administer WordPress, when you're actually an admin for it, it's yours, and you go over to the settings, you can actually install plugins. WordPress kind of is this creepily easy thing to update. You don't need special software or anything. You just need to get it running. And once you do that, getting the email users is one of the, it's the first one I saw, right? It just allows you to send email to all the users, assuming they put the right email in. The thing you got to be careful about when you start sending emails, you got to make sure that the person that receives the email can stop the email from coming. And if you can't do that, then you're considered a spammer. So you have to make sure you say very clearly and easily, I'm sending this, you know, it's really polite to just be at the end, say, I'm sending this email because of these reasons. If you don't want to receive this, please let me know. And even if the system doesn't support the turning auto off, if you add your email just at the bottom and you take care of it yourself. And so then there's a little bit of WordPress user management. I'm just suggesting that one because I know it will work. There's probably solutions like this for every single CMS out there. That's a content management system. But I don't think you'll find this kind of service for something like Tumblr, which is a free service for blog posting, because this emailing to users is something we're trying to get away from in the blogging space. You kind of say, hey, this is where my content is, and you can come and view it anytime you want, and then you let them take care of the auto-updating aspect of it. But I got to say, I follow a couple blogs that have this service, and I love getting that email which summarizes some of the topics, because then I can determine if I'm going to read. So it's a good trigger as well.
The related question would be, is do I worry about putting my regular email address out there, or should I come up with some kind of...
Do not use your regular email address. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's really crucial.
So I should... Do something like get a Yahoo address, and then they'd all reply to that.
Yeah, that's a good way to do it. Just make sure you check that email. Once you start down this road, you have to check that second email. What would be really nice is
you
could actually
be willing to give it up after 6 months and put a new email up.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, the one thing you could do is if you get a domain, you do email forwarding, email aliasing. So you create an email address that's June 2012. And then you use that email for June 2012, and then you delete it, and you make another one for the next month. Or you use one for a certain period of time, or you call one Raspberry Pink Dogs at your website, right? And then at some point, when too much spam is happening through that because you've posted it publicly, you just turn it off and put a new one on your website. And that's an easy way to kind of – that's how I normally manage clients. I normally make an email address that is disposable. And then the real email address I leave alone, and I don't ever actually publish that. But when I send email to people, or when you would send email to people – directly, you would want to use that email address because that way you know they're a real person and you want to tell them how to communicate with you all the time. Okay?
Well, thanks a lot for the info.
Certainly. Thank you for the call.
Bye.
Raspberry Pink Dogs?
First thing that came to my head.
That's awesome.
Was it Raspberry Pink Dogs?
It was Raspberry
might
Pink
be
Dogs.
Might be the title of today's show. Let's go ahead and take a call from Santa Cruz. Don, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, Lyle. Is there a way to give up cable and still see Rachel Maddow's live broadcast?
The live broadcast, I don't know.
My intuition would be probably not.
Yeah. Okay.
If you lived in New York City, I could say, yeah, there is a service you could do that with that we covered. But outside of New York City, I can't think of anything.
I think they keep Santa Cruz in a different place.
Santa Cruz is a bubble.
Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Well, we got some time to do some more geek news, if either of you have them. I think it's actually Miles' turn.
Yes, let's see. What should I cover next? How about... Have any of you ever heard of the Dunning-Kruger study?
I've heard of it, but I can't remember what it is.
Ditto.
How poignant, because it's basically saying that the... more incompetent you are at something, the more competent you think you are at it.
Okay.
The less you know about something.
So this is when you test people for a certain skill set and you actually ask them to assess themselves and then you test them, the people that say that they're really good are actually worse than the people that say they aren't very good. And it's very it's very similar to this idea, the more you know, the more you don't know. Yes, thank you very much.
Yes, exactly that. And it also explains why many people go into federal politics.
I see.
And why people who should be there aren't there. Sorry, a little dig there.
I don't think anyone's going to be upset at you for attacking federal politics. I think you're safe.
Well, people have been looking at this. This was a study that was done in 1999 and has now been part of general curriculum for psychologists. Or in psychologists in training, I should say. And it is very difficult to recognize one's own incompetence. And we are very well aware of it doing the show. as will spout off, and then someone will go, yeah, you're completely wrong. And, like, and the thing that is being learned from this, actually, is that it's not that you can't figure out whether one person's argument is better than another.
Interesting.
It's that it's not so much whether you can trust someone else. People's facilities are actually reasonably good at this, assuming that you have some training in learning about logical fallacies and the like. But at the same time, you just need to learn to accept that you may not be wrong, or you may not be right. That, sorry. Yes.
So, I'm confused.
To have something, this really points out the notion of don't really assume that you're right about anything. Like, really, if someone challenges you on something, to really say, "Wow, let me think about whether I'm really right about that." Of course, we won't do that because we'll say, like, "No, of course I'm right about that." The more wrong you are, the more right you are.
Isn't interesting? I mean, is this something that you have to focus on because you have so much positive feedback on when you're right because it's almost all the time that when you're wrong, is it really hard for you to see that?
Yes, or because when I'm around people that could actually call me on it, Becca, then you start seeing how often you're wrong. In my area of expertise, I can be right a lot. But then I start assuming, like many people do, in an area outside of your expertise, that you are also correct because something seems intuitive.
Yeah. And the trick, of course, in having a successful life is accepting that and enjoying that fact.
It's just kind of saying, like,
oh, I get to learn now all the time.
I was wrong. Okay.
Let's move on. I'll try not to do that again. All right. So so what you're saying was this study kind of supports the idea that you really should anytime anybody brings challenges, you really should start from the base and work yourself back up. And then maybe even explain that pattern of why you think that way so that they can correct you in the spot that you're missing.
Right.
Right.
Now, if you have an advanced degree in something and you've been studying it for a long period of time and that justification to say how things are going, you know, why do I believe this way? It's going to be pretty easy to follow through. But if you haven't been studying it for that long, yeah, you really need to go back and check your first principles.
Assume you're wrong all the time.
Good to live by.
Good unless
principle
another,
to live by. Yeah, unless, I think I a word there.
One more little bit. We're running low on the end of the show.
I've got a pretty quick one. For a very long time, we've been doing retina scans thinking that the retina did not change. However, like the fingerprints don't change, you know? However, your retinas actually do change. So after just a couple of years, they change like, 150%, 200%, 250%. And the changes are cumulative. So after 10 years, your retina is very different than it used to be,
if your retina changes 100%, it's pretty different. Yeah. What is that?
The number of false positives. That's what I meant to
say. Okay, the number of false positives increase that much.
Exactly.
Even worse if they're diabetic because then your eye changes dramatically within 3 to 5 months.
Wow. Hey, GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Cruzio Works, rentable workspaces located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz, featuring 40 new private offices, meeting rooms, an organic cafe, and 100 megabits per second Wi-Fi. More information at cruzio.com/CruzioWorks or at 459-6301. This is GeekSpeak. We're here every week. Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.
And Rick, thanks for answering the phones. If you have questions for us throughout the week, we are, of course, available. Just go to geekspeak.org and send us email through there. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. My name is Lyle Troxell, and coming up next will be Car Talk, as I hear.